Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 188. Science Faction, the next period.
Sounds like the sequel to Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret.
Of course you knew you would make a menstrual joke, Damien. You just can't restrain yourself, can you?
That was a literary joke that happened to be about menstruation.
First of all, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret is not what we would consider a literary joke, okay? You're not exactly referencing Dostoevsky.
This is the highest grade level book I've ever read, and it helped me through some tough times.
He's just expressing what every guy thinks.
Right.
Every month. That's yes. One more to go. Come on. Just one at a time.
I'm going to write my own book called Are You There, God? It's Me, Bobby. Please stop, Damien. Indeed. So we're going to talk about the next period. We've talked about all the periods, all the geological periods of Earth's history. And now we want to talk about what we might expect in the next period. By the way, guys, this does mean that you have only 1 week to get your tweets in telling us what you'd like our next intro bit to be. Because starting next week, we will have a whole new intro bit. So please tweet us at Faction Science and let us know what you think our new intro bit should be.
Maybe we need a carrot and stick situation here. Like, hey, if we don't get the prerequisite amount of votes, mm-hmm. it will be euphemisms for dong.
No, you are the only one getting the stick there, which isn't the only time I've said that before. But you would be the only one being rewarded for that. That wouldn't be fair. Instead,
we'd punish our audience for not participating.
No, that would be fun. Okay, Damien is just going to talk for the first half of every episode, unless you guys give us some good things to do for an intro bit.
How about civilizations?
Oh, I like that. Like we'd go back and be like the Phoenicians.
Mesopotamians,
okay.
Phoenicians.
I like that. I like that. Very archaeology based. I feel like we could do well with that.
The
you
Irish.
Could, you could throw dinosaurs in there too.
God damn it. All right. So what do we what does the next period hold? What does our future hold? We're going to see some really big changes over the next few millennia. Even just in the next few hundred years, we're going to see a rising of sea levels, warming of global temperatures, a melting of a significant portion of ice reserves of water throughout the world, and a huge release of the CO2 that's trapped up not only within them, but within cold water, which releases that CO2 as it warms up. So we're going to see kind of a little bit of a runaway greenhouse effect that should last at least for the next 100 years or so, and we will probably see a continuation of that throughout the next millennium.
We will see all of these things, and if you're somebody who denied that it was happening now, you will be hearing a lot of I told you so as well.
Absolutely you will.
No, you won't, because you'll be dead.
Yes.
In 100 years.
My grandkids will be mocking your grandkids.
But you will also see a continuation of the sixth mass extinction, which we're currently in, where we're going to continue to see large animals especially die out, but most animals will be dying out. Certain ones will actually prosper and do really, really well. Things like rats, insects like cockroaches that can live around our garbage.
Pigeons.
Pigeons. Cattle. Cattle are one of the most successful species, Darwinistically speaking, on the face of this earth, because it's took this really, really narrow genetic footprint and has made it probably pound for pound some of the greatest biomass of any mammal on earth.
I know there's a lot of concern out there for the elephant, but I think we're going to keep them around because if computers go down, we need a place to store data, and nobody remembers like an elephant.
Right, they never forget. There's only two times you can always remember information. One is if you give it to an elephant. Two is if you learned it on 9/11. Either of those two things, you're good.
That's a great 9/11 joke. Yeah,
thank you.
And you were shitting on my period, my literary joke earlier.
Second only to Camille Nanjiani's in The Big Sick. Go check it out. Good movie. But regardless, we're going to see that work. We're going to see some plate tectonic issues. We're going to see some major quakes come through areas like where we're currently living in California. While people talk about California sliding off into the sea, that will almost certainly not happen. But what will happen is you'll see this landscape transformed by large tectonic events. You're going to see the continuation of the Peninsular Mountain Range being pushed up as those plate tectonics move. You're going to see a lot of shaking and a lot of slab foundations destroyed that Southern California mass suburban homemakers like to use all the time. You're going to see a lot of coastal areas get flooded in. You're going to see a lot of migration over the next about 100 years to 150 years. One of the largest human migrations, probably the largest human migration in all of history, will happen in the next 150 years as we see massive amounts of coastal populations have to move inland with rising seas. Since a disproportionate percentage of our human population is concentrated around ocean coasts, both for fishing and resources and shipping and all of that, we have a lot of people who will be displaced with rising sea levels disproportionate to the amount of land that is lost. You might just think, oh man, 3 foot rise in sea level, that can't be that much. It's going to devastate a lot of areas. There are entire states like Florida that will be underwater in about 200 years.
Oh, shit. For a second, I thought, like, let's just say you're from Nebraska, you're going to get flooded with Californians. Oh, my God, they're going to bring their tech companies and great economy, but you're going to get Floridians.
That's right. It's the only thing worse than actually getting flooded over with seawater completely is we're just going to flood you with Floridians.
There has to be a way. Can we put, like, a fence around Florida so that they perish with the state? Like, they go down with the state?
Now, a significant portion of whether the future is good or bad is going to depend on one factor, which is whether or not human beings get their population under control. Our future looks vastly different if we're looking at a future world with 16 billion people on the face of the planet or 5 billion people on the face of the planet. So if we are able to spread ideas like birth control, if we're able to spread the ability of parents to choose when and whether they're going to have children and how many children they have, if we spread the idea that, for instance, having two children is and putting a lot of resources and investment into those two children is preferable to having 10, which you don't put resources and investment in, we may end up having a very bright future in humanity. The fact of the matter is you still have to turn that tide because the vast majority of the world is still overpopulating. It is still growing at an enormous rate, and it is something that is just simply not sustainable. So in the end, whether we're seeing...
No, it'll stop on its own. There's no... You can do a basic calculation if you keep...
Right.
If you keep the population rate, growth rate, the same...
Right.
And figure out, okay, how long before human... All of the... mass of the universe is in human beings, it's 10,000 years. So something's going to give way before that.
Well, no, we wouldn't make it anywhere near 10,000 years. I mean, the carrying capacity of the Earth isn't anywhere near like double our current population. So if we went up to about 16 billion, that's bigger than the carrying capacity of the Earth. So if we just
Something's going to give whether we change or not.
Right. Well, true. And when the problem is how this change happens. So does it become from cataclysmic war and rationing and some people not being able to get water and that kind of thing? Or does it happen because people are taking birth control pills? You know, so that we have two options in this. It will be interesting to see which of those options we decide to take.
I could see a lot of politicians hoping for a plague to come around just so that they're blameless. Like, hey, we didn't have to genocide anybody. Yeah. This plague did it for us.
I don't think birth control will win because a culture that breeds will outbreed a culture that doesn't.
Not always. I mean, if you look...
Unless the one that breeds dies really faster than it breeds.
Yes. So, like, if you look at what's happening, for instance, in sub-Saharan Africa right now, you're having groups that are having a lot more kids and not necessarily nearly as much birth control, but nobody would... you know, claim that sub-Saharan Africa is dominating the global marketplace. And so because of that and their inability to then have an entire society that produces weapons and aircraft carriers and everything else, you know, who knows if it came down to who wins, the U.S. or sub-Saharan Africa, it's not going to be sub-Saharan Africa in that fight.
Well, it could be Muslims.
Yeah,
it could be a lot.
And it could be different groups of different types. I mean, even when you say Muslims, you couldn't have you would have infighting among that group too.
So you're saying if sub-Saharan Africa were to have some sort of PSA about pulling out, we might be able to have a decent competitor.
Let me tell you this too, and I don't want to pick on sub-Saharan Africa because we have a fucking problem in the aforementioned Nebraska. You know, we have problems here in the United States. One of the highest teen pregnancy rates right now is in Texas. Texas has actually surpassed many third world nations in terms of teen pregnancy rates and non-married pregnancy rates because they've over the past two decades have dismantled their reproductive healthcare system. They've completely restricted access to sexual information to kids. So you don't have any sex ed training and you have little to no access to birth control and essentially now zero access to abortions within the state of Texas. So when you combine all that all together, you're essentially turning
How
Texas
do they
into
not
a third
have access to birth control.
Very little access to birth control. So the rules in which you can give birth control to young people are incredibly strict there, including parental consent.
You mean, under 18?
Yeah, and the ability to get it where you are locally. So the main distributor of birth control for a long time has been Planned Parenthood, and as they slowly, basically in the last two decades, shut down as almost every single one of places in Texas, you've cut off a massive supply of birth control to those people.
Is it true that in Europe, like in France, for example, their sex ed teaches you to go down on somebody of either sex?
So
listen, part of if you're teach sex ed, teach somebody to be good at it. You know, want to please partners. Listen, you know, Texas's orgasms per female is abysmal right down there.
I was wondering why you become a pen pal with so many French teenagers. What is this your idea of how education works?
I'm a tutor.
All right, and speaking of a tutor, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damian Mercado. Damian, how are you doing this afternoon?
It's doing great. It's been a while since we've had an intro that long.
Absolutely, it is. And, of course, our scientist for the evening, Seb. Seb, how are you doing?
Doing great. Glad to be back. Two weeks in a row.
2 weeks in a row, and we're going to beat Damian once again, and I call BS.
Seb's always here 2 weeks in a row. He's never just here, like, he never takes a week off. It's a weird
He's
pattern.
Like twins. But with one guy. And, of course, check out our website at www.thesciencefaction.com for all the articles we cover here, as well as some we didn't get to. And make sure you tweet us what you think our new intro bit should be at Faction Science. But for now, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
All right, article number one, why do people believe in conspiracies?
You just can't take losing that debate, can you?
Yeah, the flat earth debate, it's really mounted up to me. What's funny is I actually chose this article because of some experiences we had in that flat earth debate, including a lot of research that I did. I wanted to understand not only the flat earth concept, but a lot of the stuff that's behind conspiracies, conspiracy theorists, and why these people believe certain things that they believe, because there's a lot of contradictory beliefs. One of the first things you stumble across when you start researching conspiracy theories and conspiracy theorists is that they are more likely to hold two contradictory conspiracy theories at the same time than they are to accept an established theory. Meaning, they're more likely to believe that Osama bin Laden was killed before the U.S. raid or that Osama bin Laden is still alive. They are literally more likely to believe both of those at the same time, even though those are mutually exclusive events, than believe that the U.S. Navy SEALs killed Osama bin Laden in that raid.
Or if you believe the Jews control the world.
Right.
Also, but also you believe aliens control the world.
Yes. Well, that's when you get to the lizard people, which becomes...
Jews are aliens. They were the first tribe of Israel.
Yeah, that's right. It all makes sense. So that kind of seems super contradictory to me. How would you be more likely to accept two shitty stories than one story with more evidence? You know, the same thing is especially true with 9/11. There's a lot of conspiracy theories about 9/11, which people will ardently believe and defend, holding simultaneously two views that are mutually exclusive. And when you encounter that, it makes any rational person go like, what is this? What is it that is making them believe not just one thing that seems kind of silly and foolish, because we can all analyze evidence differently, and maybe you're not great at analyzing evidence, so fine. But how are you believing two mutually exclusive and contradictory things as opposed to the one thing that has more evidence than either of those two combined? You know, and it just seems hard to do and hard to pull off.
I've seen countless temperatures that can't melt steel.
That's right.
I mean, I think the range, like, from 400 to 1,000 degrees Celsius can't melt steel.
Well, I started looking into some of that stuff and what makes people believe it. And a lot of time, I've thought for a long time that the novelty of belief is what drives a lot of conspiracy theorists. And this is what this particular article suggests. So this particular article suggests that people want to have unique views or unique beliefs. And that is part of viewing themselves as unique individuals and unique people.
So they're like hipsters, but for ideas, right?
It's actually a lot like that. They found two separate studies actually found that people who believe that the moon landings were fake, that vaccines cause autism, all those type of conspiracy theories, it suggests that these people believe those because they feel more unique by holding unique views. So it's not...
That's exactly like hipsters.
Yeah,
they
it is.
They believe they're oppressed even though they're at Yale.
Well, no, they believe... they want to like a band that nobody else has heard from before. And it doesn't matter if that band is still quantitatively as good as when you heard it. Once other people like it, you no longer like it because you're no longer unique. You're right. It's exactly what that is.
So when they're saying it, we hear anti-vax, but what they hear is... like my new vest and hat?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Pabst Blue Ribbon, I'm drinking it ironically. That's exactly correct, yeah. And so it becomes this thing where if I hold these unique views, then I'm not like the rest of these people. Look how different I am. Look how special I am. And all these people, they just can't see through it, you know. They're the sheeple. What's interesting about it is it seems to suggest that if you really wanted to combat conspiracy theories, you'd make them really popular. Like, the more people who believe in it, the less likely those people who take it too far would be to actually believe in it.
Like, so, I was a fan of Jesse Ventura before he was popular.
Let me tell you this, buddy. I got to tell you, this is a serious thing. When I started looking up this flat earth debates thing, I was looking at people, and you wouldn't believe how many of these flat earthers state with pride, like the first thing they will state isn't, here is what I believe or here is my evidence. It's this, it's, I have been a flat earther since 2007. I've been one since 2006. I first heard of, they all want to have this big cock measuring contest on who has been dumbest the longest. It's insane. And they're really into it. Like, their big thing is, oh, I'm going to post this YouTube video proving, look, this is me back in high school. And this is me thinking the earth was flat back then.
Just a stoner in class. Like, yeah, man, what if the earth was a bong?
Well, 1,000 people took part in this survey, and the researchers found that people who supported conspiracy theories were more likely to think that they had information that no one else had. They also found that those who wanted to be more unique were also more likely to believe in that particular theory. The same was true of people who were encouraged to be unique. So people who viewed it as a value were more likely to have conspiracy theories or believe in conspiracy theories.
Encouraged to be unique. I'm picturing like a kid who's like, his parents take him to flat earth practice. Mom, I just want to go to the science fair. No, you're going to be unique.
In other studies, they found similar findings, mainly that people who wanted to be unique were more likely to believe and endorse conspiracy theories, and that a made-up conspiracy theory received more support when participants were told that only a minority of people believed in it. So if you want to make a conspiracy theory that's really popular, ironically, you need to downplay its popularity and tell people that it's, hey, no one believes in this stupid shit.
This isn't even on Alex Jones's radar yet.
Yeah,
this
no,
is,
this he would.
Is good.
He wouldn't
Alex
touch it.
Jones admit he was like an act?
Yes, he did. Yeah. His lawyer did, technically.
His lawyer did, but then didn't he go on like the next day and like basically just, you know.
Yeah, but he's an act.
I'll show you what an act is.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Judges don't. He ended up, like, didn't he lose the case big time because of that shit? Because judges don't like when you go basically go out and tell them, hey, I'm lying to the court.
So what's really interesting is I was looking at previous research on this before, and there's other things that we see highly associated with conspiracy theories. So the first is obviously there are some mental disorders. If somebody's a schizophrenic, they're going to be very likely to believe in some pretty crazy shit. But then you have other things.
Those people, like, they believe conspiracy theories in their sort of just like in their families and stuff. Everyone's
right.
Against me.
Yes, and, yeah. True. Very true. That's a good way to put it. But there's also a personality spectrum or a spectrum of personality disorder, in which this person isn't schizophrenic, they don't have that type of mental impairment, but they do have a personality disorder, including one called schizotypical personality disorder. And that is kind of like a spectrum that almost ends with schizophrenia. But in between, there's a bunch of stuff. And a lot of it is, one, wanting to have super unique views, believing in really kind of far out there things. So a lot of these conspiracy theorists do have something mentally going on, whether it's schizophrenia. Sometimes bipolar can bring this in because people are in manic stages and they believe they see connections where they don't. Sometimes it's a personality disorder, like schizotypic personality disorder. One that I thought was really interesting was there's a compounding thing that we see in a lot of conspiracy theorists that seems contradictory. It's a mixture of narcissism, which kind of does make sense, too, if you think about it, because what do you have to believe to think that all the experts who have studied their entire life who are much smarter than you are wrong, but you are right? You have to be somewhat narcissistic. And number two...
Or perhaps you just believe that all these experts haven't seen this YouTube video that you saw that totally blew.
And number two, which is kind of interesting, and you wouldn't pair this with narcissism necessarily, a low sense of self-esteem. So you wouldn't think that. You would think narcissists, they have high sense of self-esteem. That's not really what a clinical narcissist is. So a narcissist might be obsessed with themselves or might think that they themselves are the most important thing in the world, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they have a high sense of self-esteem. In fact, sometimes they have very low senses of self-esteem, and this contributes to that kind of following effect. When you see that big group of followers latch on to anybody, whether it's Wakefield or Jenny McCarthy or somebody else promoting a conspiracy theorist.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, any of those people. When you see those people latch on in that way, a lot of times it's because they have such low self-esteem that they attach their value to the person that they're following. So therefore, you can have a clinical narcissist who's sitting there going, here's why I'm right and I'm smarter than all these other people. And then you have a bunch of people with low self-esteem looking at them being like, man, that guy, he's got something going for him. I'm going to believe in him over everybody else.
Your opponent in the debate, in the flat earth debate, the flat earther, the only thing I could think when he was talking was, man, a science teacher must have made you feel really dumb one day.
Just beat him with rulers?
Just like you were going to get him back.
So this leads us to some interesting things, which is maybe if you want to defeat conspiracy theories, then you do it by either popularizing them or telling everybody that they're popular. If you want to spread your own, you tell everybody that it's super unpopular and nobody knows about it yet.
So if all of us were wearing flat earth shirts tomorrow, if we get Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Then eventually, yes, then he would absolutely leave. But very, very interesting stuff, and it's something you should keep an eye on because it tells us how people think. And a lot of times one of the problems we make, if you're a rational, logical person, you make the mistake of thinking, I just need to present the evidence to these people, and then once they see the evidence, they'll change their mind. We have to understand that not everybody is evidence-based or evidence-driven, and that's not the ultimate goal.
Most people aren't, even scientists.
I would say to some extent most people are, because most people still end up taking their kid to the ER at the end of the day. You know, most people aren't going to sit there and pray over their dead body. Some people will.
Yeah. I think you got to make a difference between people who have actually like articulated in their head, this is evidence-based, and people who they act out an evidence-based behavior, but they haven't actually realized that they're doing that.
Yeah, and most people, like, put it this way. If a super evangelical Christian person is standing right there, and all of a sudden their kid collapses and starts having a seizure, and there's a nurse or somebody or an EMT around that says, this is a seizure, and this kid, he needs to get medical attention, or he's going to die instantly. He's going to die in the next half hour. If that person sits there and starts praying over them, then they're probably not very evidence-based. If they load them up into the car and head out to the Cedars-Sinai Hospital, they probably care more. When it gets down to it, they might say they believe in the word of God more than anything else, but they believe in the ER guy with a stethoscope fixing their kid.
You can hedge your bets. You can do both.
Yes, you can. That's true. Yeah. And undoubtedly they would. Undoubtedly they would do both.
And if you have a handsless prayer, you can pray while driving illegally in the state of California.
That's
if you have a Bluetooth prayer adapter.
All right, let's move right on to article number two. We want to revisit the EM drive. So we're not actually even going to look at one specific article. Seb, since you are our physics expert, we had a long time where unfortunately we didn't have you in, and there was a bunch of EM drive news. We really wanted to get back to this because I think this is one of the most interesting physics articles that's been released in the last few years. You know way more about this than the rest of us, so we'd like to talk to you about it. So let's go briefly over this. You guys have probably heard us talk about EM drive a whole bunch, but if you haven't, it's the idea of a motor, so to speak. It's providing thrust in an element like space. This wouldn't be something you would use for your car running through the streets. So the idea behind this EM drive is that it's actually able to produce thrust without shooting a single thing outside of it.
You're basically bouncing light between mirrors.
Inside of a contained structure.
Yeah.
Now, those of you who have a physics background know that if you wanted to exert a force on something, you have to exert an equal and opposite force the other way, which seemingly would mean that bouncing a particle inside of a contained unit where that particle never exits could not create a net thrust because, it bounces off one side, it bounces to the other, and at no point is it creating a net thrust in a particular way or direction. But over and over again, starting in the early 2000s, researchers seem to have shown some kind of net thrust with this, starting, oddly enough, in like almost pseudoscience-y circles, and then moving up, got tested, I guess, fairly extensively in China. It's been being tested by NASA for the past 6 or 7 years. They seem to show thrust over and over again. And physics-wise, Seb, this does seem impossible on its face, right?
Well, answer, yes.
Yes, yeah. If the thrust is correct. Yeah. Now, this is a small amount of thrust, so this is very hard
to
measure.
There are a couple. Well, I've heard one possible explanation.
Okay.
I came up with another one. Maybe that's not a good one. I don't know.
Okay.
But one explanation that I heard that I thought was kind of clever is that so in quantum physics, you have waves, but they have to fit inside whatever constraint you're in. So say like a wave on a string, like on a guitar string, has to fit on the guitar string because it can't vibrate at the ends.
Right.
And so only certain waves, and waves are associated to momentum.
Right.
And so I read this one guy who was saying, well, maybe only certain waves fit in the universe, and as the universe expands, you get these changes in momentum, and that's actually what we're observing.
Really?
Now
why would we only observe it in the EM drive? What is it about the EM drive that would allow us to observe the change of those waves?
Well, I think it's just we haven't really just watched something sitting still in a vacuum.
But we do watch stuff, right? Because we have controls and...
Yeah. So okay. I don't know. That was his idea.
What's yours?
My idea was that all of physics is based on this concept of an inertial frame,
okay,
which is a frame in which nothing is accelerating. Everything's moving at a constant speed. The problem is, even Newton, who came up with this, said that doesn't exist.
Right.
It's an idealization, and his theories ran into problems. So he said you could approximate that if you're, if you don't watch something for too long. So say like you want to watch a pendulum on the Earth. If you watch it for 5 minutes, you'd say, yeah, I'm in inertial frame. But if you watch it for a day, all of a sudden, because the Earth's rotating, that has an effect and you realize I'm not in inertial frame. Okay. So Newton said, yeah, okay, so you can say your inertial frame as long as you don't watch it for too long.
Yeah.
And then Einstein came and said, well, actually, there's another problem is you can't move around in space too much for your inertial frame. And he came up with general relativity. But still, everything's based on this inertial frame. So I think maybe if these things hold up, maybe one explanation is there's actually no such thing as inertial frame, but all our physics is based on the existence of inertial frame. And so maybe we're running into problems there.
Okay.
Because the conservation of momentum only holds in an inertial frame. And if there's no such thing as an inertial frame, you may eventually run into problems.
Okay, that's an interesting one. Let me ask you this, because the shape of the device seems to maybe be part of it. Now, the shape is such that one side is narrower than the other. So if you think of, don't think of a cylinder. Instead, think of it like, you know,
a fleshlight.
Yeah, exactly. No, you know those dog cones, the cones they put on dogs when they have to get surgery or something? Imagine taking one of those off a dog and you have that. And then, so you seal both sides off on that hole and then you bounce the particle back and forth. If you think about it, like you said, that particle is bouncing back and forth, right? But it has a much bigger space on which it is hitting, the big open side of the dog cone. It has a much bigger space that it's hitting and directing force towards that direction. The smaller side that it's hitting, it might sometimes be hitting the sides, in which case, because of, you know, it would only be delivering a certain amount of angular momentum directly towards the front of it, wouldn't you have more thrust going one way than the other?
Well, I think that's the idea.
Okay.
It gets thrusted in, I don't remember which direction they find.
I think it goes towards the larger side. I think the thrust, pushes towards the larger side.
So, I mean, maybe there's something like, so the thing is like your momentum, the spread in your momentum is bigger on the bigger side.
Yep.
You could have a bigger range of up and down momentum instead of straight across. And so, you know, maybe that has something to do with it.
Yeah.
But according to classical physics, this doesn't make sense.
Interesting. And one of the things too to think about is this would be a huge benefit for any kind of long range space travel. So while it's all semantics when we're talking about here on Earth, in fact, it's so hard to even measure this thrust on Earth that we don't even know if we're getting thrust or not half the time, even with super advanced experiments.
So like physicists are like, is it in?
That's exactly what they're saying. Yeah. Well, but when we start thinking about space travel, we got to remember the rules go completely out the window and we have a whole different way of doing this, because once we get into space travel, once you get moving, you keep that same speed. There's no air to slow you down. So assuming you're not running into a lot of debris and whatnot, you get going 20 miles an hour, you'll stay going 20 miles an hour ad infinitum until you hit something. So you'll keep going. And that means that if you speed up just a tiny bit, just put a little bit of energy and now you're going 21 miles an hour. Now you're going 20, and that little bit of acceleration mounts up. And so what we can do with this type of device is you could have something like a solar cell or something that's collecting solar energy. And we know from our Voyager experiments that solar cells will last a long, long time. In fact, if you have a big enough solar sail, it might even work in between solar systems very well. So you can collect solar energy. And since you don't need physical fuel, if you can just boom, boom, send out electrical magnetic particles inside of this thing the entire time, you could essentially create a device that got pretty close to the speed of light, or at least given enough
eventually,
time.
Yeah.
It would get right up near the speed of light.
The question is, how long would that take?
Yeah, I'm sure you can do that actually pretty quickly on a...
I haven't done the calculations, but...
We talked a few episodes back about liquid plasma drives.
Not liquid plasma, but
plasma engines for space flight,
yes.
Right? So would this be, would the EM drive be like the bicycle to the plasma engine's car? Like,
well, plasma engine would take a lot more energy, first of all. But I think even just the magnetic containment field would take a lot. I think the plasma is more practical. You can deliver a lot more force. This would be like a long-range probe that you sent out. You wanted something that was going to be able to go really, really far, Voyager on steroids, and you want to send this off to many, many different solar systems all around the galaxy. This would be the type of technology you could use, because if you could design something that was long-living enough, theoretically, you could reach the most distant spots.
Well, the problem is the human being on the planet...
Oh, we'd be long gone.
Be around to receive the messages.
Oh, no. We're long gone. Yeah, that wouldn't work. No, this is more of sending out the golden record that's got the record of humanity on it so other civilizations know we existed.
So thank you, Captain Janeway, for the Voyager.
That's right. That is what I was referring to, of course.
Tuvok right there along the...
Yeah.
Good right hand.
So, but regardless, Seb, if this ends up turning out to be true, if we end up finding this out, will this put into question other parts of physics, or do you think that if we end up...
No, because physics is still just, it's science. It's right. Does it work? So whether this theory holds up or not, all the other ones still work.
But is it going to put into question the other things that we have based on this kind of... this would be conservation of momentum, right?
Yeah.
Would it put in other put into question other ideas we have based on conservation of momentum?
Well, it'd put into question like the underlying theory right. underneath everything we have. But it's like general relativity came along and said Newton's wrong, but mm-hmm. we still use Newton because it still works.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work in certain cases, right. but for most of the time, it still works. So
and that's
it's still
the way
just
science
a good enough theory.
That's the way science works for the most part. Science very rarely completely overturns an idea. It usually just modifies yeah. an existing idea to make it better.
Which is why phrenology is still a science.
That's right. It is.
Nothing's
still
overturned it.
Somebody with an occipital lobe like you would think like that, Damien. All right, let's move right on to everybody's favorite game. I call BS.
I call.
Ring, ring.
I call BS.
We can't get Respans to respond to what to name the next episodes, but somehow, through your polling data, you've gathered that this is everybody's favorite game.
Literally everybody's favorite game. All right, I call BS, the game where I read out 4 science news articles, and my panelists compete to see which ones are real and which ones are BS, standing for bad science. Are you guys ready to play?
I am ready to take a knee through this national anthem.
Yes, that's right.
I had a victory stolen
worry,
from
Damien.
Me last week.
Damien, it's okay. You lose every week, but you will soon win. One of these days, you will come back and win one of these episodes.
Miscarriage of justice last episode. In my mind, I'm 2 victories in.
Okay, let's go. Article number 1. An ancient Egyptian pharaoh has been found to have been the first known giant. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is science, and they actually found him in an old Egyptian Princess Bride movie on an archaeological... Fuck off. It's Andre the... He's an Egyptian Andre the Giant. He speaks funny.
Drinks casks of beer.
Big hat.
All right, and Seb.
I guess I don't know what the definition of a giant is.
Well, I can't give away too much because I don't want to give an unfair advantage on this particular one. But I will say, giant doesn't necessarily have anything to do with your height.
Okay, so what I'm thinking it means, there's some sort of abnormality that makes you tall, but not normally tall. Like a dwarf might have something wrong with them that makes them a dwarf.
Right. We're all giant dwarfs when you think about it.
I suppose that could happen. Maybe he's got a glandular problem like Andre the Giant. And
to call bad science on the part where you said you were trying to be fair.
Yeah.
And as somebody, you are not fair.
That is true. I am trying to get Damien to win one of these.
Kim Jong-un of this game.
Article number 2, researchers have developed a computer chip that helps heal wounds faster. Damien's is science or bad science?
This is science, but yes, it's a computer chip, but it goes into a robot. That robot then will stitch your wounds together.
Oh, okay.
And clean it.
And Seb.
Well, by that definition, it's definitely science.
All right, article number 3, researchers have found that shocking your brain can help you learn a skill. Damien's is science or bad science?
This is science, because I know electroshock is like the one torture you could do to somebody that has like a lot of medical benefits.
Is that why you keep buying all those cattle prods?
Especially with depressed women.
Yeah, listen, I'm just saying, I don't see waterboarding coming along as some homeopathic cure. Oh yeah, we're gonna waterboard the gay away.
At least it works. Like, it's better than homeopathy in that sense.
No, you're right. Science.
Well, okay. Homeopathy is just drinking water.
That's right.
Good for you.
Seb, what about you? You think researchers found that shocking your brain can help you learn a new skill?
I guess it would depend on the skill. Maybe
the skill of learning to not get shocked.
It might help you be a better, shocking the brain. Maybe you'll be a better football player. They take a lot of shocks.
Yeah,
to the
it's
head,
true. You so. Just get that CTE
but
out
I'm,
of the
I'm
way.
I'm going to say I can't imagine that's a good idea. I'm going to say bad science.
All right.
You learn not to get caught by a Russian agent again.
All right, and lastly, article number 4. Researchers have found that using your air conditioning in traffic adds a dangerous amount of pollutants to the inside of your car. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science, but I don't think they controlled for the amount of flatulence in the car and the
right.
flatulence generator sitting in the driver's
it
seat.
It definitely depends who you have in the car. All right, and Seb.
I've heard the theory that AC makes pollutants outside of the car.
Yeah, obviously it does because it uses fossil fuel to run.
So. And the old ones like put out other gases.
Yes, the old ones have CFCs, yeah. Not the new ones anymore.
But inside the car, exclusively inside the car, that's weird. I'm going to say bad science.
All right. Let's go back and see how you guys did. Follow along at home and see how you did. Article number one. An ancient Egyptian pharaoh has been found to have been a giant. Both of you guys thought this one was science, and this one is science. He literally had gigantism.
Ah, okay.
And now, he was not particularly tall, though he was tall for his time. He was about 6'1".
And he also beat Hulk Hogan in a SummerSlam.
And they're not 100% sure this is the Egyptian pharaoh, because the body was found in 1901. It was found separately from any actual tomb, but basically, because of a lot of the indicators, they do think this might correlate with a particular pharaoh named Senakht, which I'm sure I'm pronouncing incorrectly.
Well-hung, yes.
Yeah, but the skeletal remains are of a tall person, but they do have gigantism, which actually Seb got this right too, happens a lot of times with a problem with a tumor on the pituitary gland, and it causes you to grow out of control. And certain parts of your body grow, your forehead grows bigger, certain parts of your body grow in different proportions, and that can be reflected in the skeleton later on. So we can actually look back and say, there certainly were people before him who had gigantism. This is the earliest evidence we have of somebody with gigantism.
Of a pharaoh with gigantism.
Of anybody with gigantism. Oh, okay. But we do have evidence of a different similar thing, which is what happens when you get the same tumor on your pituitary gland not in childhood. So if you get it in childhood, it's gigantism. And the results are different because you go through puberty with the distorted pituitary gland. There's a different thing that happens when you get that tumor after puberty. And we do have earlier examples of that, including a Native American from New Mexico like 10,000 years ago who apparently had that disease. That is more common and also less causes less issues because you don't have it the entire time you're growing up. You don't have the overactive pituitary gland.
Gigantism. It never just hits the cock.
No.
Just never.
It's a shame, right?
I'll continue to roll the dice, but I mean.
Article number two, researchers have developed a computer chip that helps heal wounds faster. Both of you guys thought this one was science, and this one is science. Created by Ohio State University, the technology is known as tissue nanotransfection, and it basically uses nanotechnology's tiny little chips that get placed on the skin of a patient and converts an adult cell from one type to another. So this is what stem cells do naturally. This is kind of being able to hijack a cell's machinery to make it do that, and it zaps the cell with a small electric charge that basically changes it from whatever cell you currently have, which is probably a skin cell or a blood cell, to the cell you need in whatever form of healing that particular one is. So you need clotting agents, boom, it does that. You need primary skin cells, infant, juvenile skin cells, things like that, it will make those. It basically helps create what you need where you need
it. Automatically?
Yeah. So it like literally zaps it and turns it.
You don't
into
have to tell it, okay, make this kind of stuff.
Oh, no,
make
you do. You do, okay. But they're programmed. The little chips are programmed, and they go through whatever you need. And so instead of basically your body putting whatever it can get where it needs to get it on its own timeline, you get what you need where you need it, and it heals those things much faster.
So if one of these things was malfunctioning, for example, though, it could be shooting me full of gametes. Like it could be.
Yeah, that's right. They just sperm all in this. Yep, exactly. Article number three, researchers have found that shocking your brain can help you learn a skill. Damien thinks this is science. Seb thinks this is bad science. And this one is science. Super, super interesting one. This we have talked about this before, about transcranial direct current stimulation, where you're actually using electricity that is being put through the skull. And this is very small voltages. People try and hack their brain, so to speak. You'll see videos of this on YouTube. I advise you not to do it, because this is done very precisely to specific parts of your brain. You doing it that way, you can't control voltage very well. You can't control what's getting to different parts of your brain. You can't control how it's happening. But we have shown over and over again that if you stimulate certain parts of the brain with transcranial direct current stimulation while you're learning certain things, you retain the memory better, you learn it faster, a lot of things happen. This is especially true when you're learning certain types of skills. And one of the stories we covered about 2 years ago was sniper training, in which it was an amazing difference. I mean, it actually made the military jump up and do a whole multi-million-dollar transcranial research project, because this direct current stimulation was the difference between a random group of soldiers, some of which who got the control and some of which who got the transcranial direct current stimulation. Some of them, the ones who got the transcranial, became shooting aces almost immediately. It was like crazy scary, whereas the other people went on a standard track that you would see advanced soldiers go on. So this is a really interesting thing.
Does that mean like baseball players are going to start doing it?
Probably. Almost every athlete, you'd think, right? Yeah. Anybody who makes money doing something, doing a complex physical skill. would be silly once this got perfected to not use it. You would be essentially putting yourself at a huge disadvantage if you didn't do it.
So at some point, the Major League Baseball is going to start testing for performance-enhancing baseball helmets.
Yeah.
That light a zero in on that pitch.
Like, it probably wouldn't help you with, like, cycling, you know, something that's purely cardio and strength and stuff like that.
But real sports.
Yeah, yeah. But for anything, like you said, baseball, certainly football. I think martial arts would probably be the best example of it, because that is a place where the skill of a certain technique is, and the difference of a few centimeters is a really big deal.
I'd like to see what happens, because if they're used in football, I'd like to see what happens to a concussed brain when transcranial current is plugged in.
Well, they did a few of these different studies. They had actually a few of them with really good control groups as well. And as these studies are coming out, they're getting better and better at having large N numbers with big control groups. They tried 6 different training tasks that were designed to measure specific cognitive skills. Some went to memory, some went to attention, some went to task switching. And they've decided to give you not just a control group that doesn't get it. They give one cognitive training. They give one cognitive training and physical fitness training, because we found that if you do certain kind of physical fitness routines while you're learning, it helps you learn. Then they gave the other group all 3, cognitive training, physical fitness, and the actual shocks. And the ones that got all 3 of those ended up doing way better than the groups that only got the other 2. You might ask, why did they do it that way? Well, think about just the process of doing transcranial direct current stimulation. You're taking somebody in a different room. You're taking time off. They're physically getting up and moving around. There could be confounding factors based on the fact that we know physical activity and getting up and moving around changes things. So you add in this as almost a secondary control. Really, really smartly done experiment. Great experimental design to kind of rule out some of the possible confounding factors. And they got very positive results. This is probably going to be something our kids use to cheat on tests. This will be the Adderall of our children's generation at some point.
Like if an iPhone has an attachment to like take shock battery
your brain,
power.
Yeah. You have like an eye taser, and you just... All right, article number 4. Researchers have found that using your air conditioning in traffic adds a dangerous amount of pollutants to the inside of your car. Both of you guys thought this one was false, and this one is bad science. Congratulations, Damien, on your first win of the year. First one I can remember in science faction history.
You sure you're not going to try to steal this one?
First in ICalBS history. You're being a really sore winner right now, Damien.
I've never been a sore winner.
Literally, you haven't, because this is the first time you've gotten to win. So this is you. This is you being your sore winner. Fine, I get it. You get one win. It's your birthday. You can cry if you want to. I get it.
I feel like right now I'm going to be lulled into opening up, to letting down my defenses.
Right.
And then right at then, Bobby's going to take this victory and give it to Seth. But, well, I'm sorry, Damien. Shedding tears is part of the bylaws.
Indeed, this is false. It's the opposite. Actually, they looked at it, they crunched all the data, they figured out that as you're driving in traffic, you're exposed to a lot of pollutants from the cars around you. This is especially true if you're driving behind like a bus or a big truck. You're getting a lot of particulate matter and a lot of other pollutants as you're driving around. However, when you roll up your windows and turn your AC on, you have 2 things happening. One is the air has to go through a filter that's in your car that pulls out some of the pollutants as it goes through. But 2, which we might not even think about, the compressor itself is cold. Think of condensation. Once you pull off, if you have an air conditioning unit in your window or even on your car, if you ever look at the end of a hot day and you pull out of a parking spot, you'll see a pool of water underneath your car. You're not leaking oil. It's the water off the condenser of your air conditioning unit. That thing gets really, really cold, and cold things get condensation on it. Water sticks to it. But you know what else cold things do? That same type of condensation attracts those pollutants. So inside the compressor, when you put everything really, really close together, you smash it together to create that cold effect, it actually also takes some of those pollutants and makes them stick to the outside and the exterior of that device as well, meaning you're using your air conditioner like a filter and going through. They found up to 3 times fewer environmental pollutants in the exact same car, depending on whether or not you have the windows up and you're using your AC, or you're just driving with your windows down to use regular to cool it in a regular fashion.
So could you argue then, if I have 5 AC units running, it's not that I'm some sort of eco-terrorist for having all this power. I'm trying to filter the atmosphere.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Well, you're really just filtering your private atmosphere.
Yes, yeah, and you're creating more greenhouse gases as you're doing it. So it's worse for everybody. It's like driving an SUV. You're safer and everybody else is fucked.
Act globally, think globally.
Yeah. Yeah, so it is one thing you might want to mention if you're one of those people who like have the if you're in the car with somebody and they're not doing the AC because they're really stingy about like gas or something like that, you might just be like, hey, you know, we're being exposed to a lot of pollutants here. It might be healthier.
If you're on the freeway First off, that asshole needs to have the AC on because it, what over 55 miles an hour.
Depending on the aerodynamics of your car, once you get over a certain amount, sometimes it's like 40 miles 20, an hour. It depends what kind of car you're driving, your aerodynamics. But yes, eventually it becomes more gas efficient to use the AC than to open a window. But they're definitely double dicks if they're not doing it now. All right, congratulations, Damien, on your first ever win.
Several. I've beaten Seb many times.
Maybe you can replicate that sometime in the future. We all know statistically that's not likely to happen.
Listen to last week's episode.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah, listen to last
week. Before shenanigans.
Last week was an absolutely excellent episode, and I'm glad you want to direct people towards even another episode where you lost. That's really big of you. Speaking of really big of you, Seb, I hear you. Your YouTube channel is going really well.
Well, I wouldn't say it's going really well, but I'm trying to make that happen. But I have a YouTube channel called Galileo's Telly. There's a series on there right now called The Little Pink Book. And you can also find my Twitter and Facebook at Galileo's Telly.
At Galileo's Telly. And if you want to...
And the YouTube is Galileo's Telescope.
Galileo's Telescope with an apostrophe. Make sure you put that in. And if you want to find us on Twitter, go ahead and check us out at Faction Science. And make sure you send us your idea for our next intro bit. Remember, this will be your last week to do so. Next week, we will have a new intro bit. All right. Thank you, audience, for joining us for 188, where you learned about the next period we'll experience in future history, why people believe in conspiracy theories, what's going on with the EM drive, the first discovery of the oldest giant, how a computer chip can help you heal your wounds, how shocking your brain can help you learn, and why you should always turn your air conditioning on when you're in traffic. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back next week for Science Faction 189.
Jesse Ventura here. I don't believe in things just because they're unique. In fact, I don't believe in anything for the same reason that anybody else believes in it.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.